lively conversation in the chat already before we got started. We have an awesome presentation for us today. Just a little bit before we get started about the Global Math Department. So it's an organization of teachers that got together through the Math Twitter blogosphere on Twitter, obviously, and also through Twitter Math Camp. And they decided to start these weekly webinars. If you've never been to one before, they're every Tuesday. Who are just sharing things that are found. If you're interested in getting involved, feel free to go to the website. And other than that, I can see in the chat I'm cutting out. So I'm gonna go ahead and turn it over to our fabulous speaker tonight, Amy Albrecht. So Amy, if you wanna go ahead and get started.
Thank you very much. It's an absolute delight to be talking in the Global Maths Department. And so before I forget, thanks to Sheila, to Sharon, and to Dylan Kane for making this happen. And also thanks to everyone who works behind the scenes to make Global Maths Department such a valuable resource for maths educators around the world. So let me know if I'm going too fast or too slow. It's a bit strange just sitting here talking to my computer. I'll probably end up using what my students call my weird video voice, but we'll see how we go. Okay, so today's talk is based on a talk I gave at the Twitter Maths Camp in Cleveland in July. And if you were there, the structure of this is the same, but I'm hoping it's better and that there were other things that you're going to get out of it as well. So as you can already see, I'm not based in North America. I'm in Adelaide, which is the capital city of South Australia. And Sydney is about 1,400 kilometres away, or a 16-hour drive. And to give you some context, the capital of Australia, Canberra, is about 3 hours drive from Sydney toward Melbourne. So a bit more context for my North American friends. South Australia as a state is 1.4 times the size of Texas, but most of us live in Adelaide. Adelaide's climate is probably most comparable to San Jose. So we have hot, dry summers and we have mild winters. But those of us in Adelaide now know that the day is actually pretty cool. We're approaching summer next month, and yet it's only going to be a high of 21 degrees Celsius. But if you come back and ask me in a month or so, it will be more likely to be in the high 30s or the low 40s. And so that's, you know, about 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay, so while I'm introducing myself, this is me as I looked yesterday while putting this talk together, rocking one of Chrissy Mule's Women Mathematicians t-shirts. And I'm a mathematician in the maths department at the University of South Australia. So part of my job is teaching mathematics to undergraduates in different degrees, and I'll come back to that later. And another part of my job is to work as a research mathematician. So I want to give you one brief look into the kinds of problems that I work on. And so I'm going to take you inside a high-speed passenger train in the UK. Now the box on the left that displays the word coast is an in-cab driver advice system. It's telling the driver how they should drive the train in order to minimize energy use and to arrive at their next destination on time. So my research group, the people that I work with, develop the mathematical algorithms that calculate the optimal driving strategies and the advice that's displayed to the driver. And that advice gets updated in real time to respond to any unplanned changes on the network. So this system is used in train cabs around the world, mostly in Europe and in the UK, and it typically saves about 10% of energy use. Now, I work on problems in railways for two reasons, and neither of them are because I particularly like trains. The first is that I find it very satisfying to use maths to solve problems that we face as a society, like reducing our energy use. And the second reason is because the underlying mathematics is so intrinsically interesting and it's very challenging. So the first time I truly glimpsed what it meant to be a mathematician was during my undergraduate degree. and some of you will have heard this story before, I went to what's called a mathematics and industry study group. And this draws together around 100 mathematicians to tackle problems that are presented by companies. So on the first day, we hear about a handful of problems presented by someone from the company. And a washing machine company person might turn up and say something like, well, we want to stop our washing machines from walking across the floor when they become unbalanced. Or another company might say, well, we want to know the best way to pack apples into cartons, because if they're overweight, we're losing profit. But if they're consistently underweight, it means our customers are unhappy. So once we listen to all of these different problems, the mathematicians decide which one sounds most appealing. And in small groups, we'll spend the next 3.5 days feverishly trying to find a solution, or at least get some idea as to what the company should investigate next. Now, for me, this was the first time I saw how mathematicians were creatively and collaboratively approaching problem solving. And it was so different to what I had experienced at school and even at university. So a colleague of the physicist Richard Feynman facetiously said that this was Feynman's approach to solving problems. And that is that Feynman would write down the problem, he'd think very hard about it, and then he'd eventually write down the answer. Now, of course, Feynman's colleague was being flippant, but I think this accurately captures how most maths learners believe you solve maths problems. And so now I want to turn it over to you for a while. I'm curious as to what you think about this description. Do you think this represents problem solving? Do you want to put your thoughts in the chat window, perhaps, and we'll see what we get? Oh, this is the interesting bit where I work out if anyone's listening or not. What do you think about Feynman's algorithm? So Eric is saying problem solving is often not linear. Tyson missing a few steps. Trial and error. Many students believe that it's so, but it's not the right way. Definitely a lot of trying things out, Pam. We've got the idea of bouncing ideas off other people and collaboration. Okay, so I'm glad you agree with me that this isn't an accurate representation of problem solving. I'm going to make 4 points, which are obviously strategic for the rest of this presentation. The first one is I'm going to pick up on the point that I think Eric made, which is this portrays thinking and problem solving as a neat and linear process. It reminds me of an idea I learned from Tracy Zager in her book that maths has a front and a back. So the front is maths in its finished form, like you find in your school textbooks and research papers and in lectures. It's neat and it's correct and it's laid out in an orderly manner, much like a needlework, right? The front of a needlework. But as we know, the back of the needlework is a messy tangle. It's full of knots and dead ends. And this is what mathematics is like amongst working mathematicians. It's what I saw at the Mathematics and Industry Study Group, the thing that convinced me to be a mathematician. And yet I think in schools and in universities, we often expect our students to memorize and reproduce the front picture without showing them how the back is a necessary support, or even that the back exists. So that's my first criticism of this way of thinking. My second is, as people were saying about collaboration, it implies that the process of solving the problem, the bit labeled think very hard, doesn't involve writing. When in fact, writing about and talking through our ideas assists our thinking. So that process helps us to make sense of our ideas and to sharpen our arguments. And we're going to come back to communicating mathematically in the last 15 minutes of this talk. The third is that I think the phrase think very hard masks all the work required to solve problems. And how do you learn how to think? what strategies can you use? And the final one is that, to me, there is no sense here in which your attitude, so your confidence, your perseverance, your interest in the problem comes into play. So, of course, it helps to have a strong foundation in concepts and skills. But I think when we focus only on these to the exclusion of all others, we're limiting our students' ability to mathematically problem solve. So, as many of you probably agree, I think we need to incorporate these additional attributes of problem solving. So intentionally developing skills in working with mathematical processes, so reasoning, communication, thinking skills, to nurture the affective aspects of learning in our students, like confidence and appreciation of mathematics, and to help our learners think about how they think, the metacognition part. Okay, so that's quite a lengthy introduction to bring me up to what the purpose of today's session is. So here's the description. I think I promised rather a lot. We'll see what happens. I'm going to talk about a subject that I designed at the University of South Australia that develops problem-solving skills in our pre-service mathematics teachers. And as you can see from the bit that I've highlighted, the aim is for students to learn how to work like professional mathematicians. And by this I mean become confident in tackling unfamiliar problems that exist in the back of mathematics, to experience the joy in asking and answering their own questions, and to work messily and collaboratively when needs be. So there are two main aims for this session. We're going to uncover aspects of problem solving via some good problems. So you'll need shortly some paper and a pen, probably. And we're also going to talk about specific strategies for progressively developing and later assessing oral presentation and mathematical writing skills. I know very few people have the luxury of teaching a problem-solving course that's not driven by content. So I'm driven by the problem-solving aspects here. So what I'm hoping is that you'll get one or two specific ideas that will help you in your current teaching or your current thinking, and I would love for you to share them with me at some stage. Okay, so we're going to start with a problem. So grab your pen and paper, and while you're doing that, let me say you could choose to engage in any number of ways. If you've never seen this problem before, just jump deep into starting to think about how you'd solve it. But if you have seen it before, look through the eyes of one of your students or put your teacher hat on and think about how you'd use it. And in a face-to-face workshop, I'd usually give it as a handout with whiteboard markers and plastic sleeves so that you could experiment with a neighbour. I'm hoping you're going to be able to make do of this on the screen. And can I also say, don't share your ideas in the chat window just yet. I want you to have some individual thinking time. Okay, so here we go. It's the chessboard squares problem. It was once claimed that there are 204 squares on an ordinary chessboard. Can you justify this claim? So what I'd like you to do is to take 2 minutes to start playing with this problem by yourself. Don't worry about trying to solve it in 2 minutes. I don't care really about whether or not you can solve it. I'm more interested in how you get started. What does the problem make you feel? What are the things that you're thinking about doing first? So in 2 minutes, I'll ask you to share in the chat window, but not just yet. Have some think time by yourself. If you want to chat about other things in the chat window, that's totally fine. But 2 minutes thinking about this problem. Well, this is kind of amazing when I can't see your faces, see what you're doing, whether you're just playing on your phones or thinking about the problem. But I'm going to give it, let's see, 20 more seconds. Okay, so without giving away any key ideas, because we don't want to unwrap people's gifts just as we're presenting it to them, can I get you to share your initial thoughts in the chat window? So what was your first emotional reaction, or what did you think when you read the question? What did you think you'd try doing first? Tell us what you think. Nice. So people want clarification on the question itself. What's meant by a square? Can they overlap? Can we make a smaller problem? John's talking about different possible sizes of squares. Eric's got, let's count all the one by ones. Evan wants to make it simpler. Ooh, Tracy's thinking that 204 is not a perfect square. So is this a rectangle? Okay. Awesome. Oh, I was going to give you a moment. I forgot that you could also check out some of the ways my pre-service teachers started approaching this problem and compare it to how you were thinking about it. So you might wonder about what they're thinking here. Okay, so I'd like to step you through some of my thinking. And in some sense, this is a front if you like, of the problem, because I've left out some of the knots and the dead ends that arose along the way. So I am going to spoil this problem for the purpose of looking back through it later and talking about the mathematical thinking. Okay, so when I read this problem, I'm thinking to myself, well, the chessboard has 64 small squares, and it's claimed that there are 204, so they must be counting something else. So I'm thinking they're counting one by ones and two by twos and all of these different size squares. So if I'm going to count all these different sizes, I want to organize my work in some way, just like Arlene has mentioned. So introduce the table and look at the extremes of the problem. What's easy to do, as Eric said, count the one by ones, and there are 64 of them. And easy as the 8x8s. And then I'm going to want to start filling in the rest of these sizes. So I'm starting to think about how to do the 2x2s. And working systematically, I can see that there are 7 places I can put this in the very top row of my grid. And these are the 7. And now I'm wondering, well, how can I count these systematically? And then I had a flash of insight. I could track the position of the top left corner of my little 2x2 square. So here are all the places it can go on the top row. It can't go in the very last column because it'll just kind of hang off the end. And here are all the places it could go in the first column. And so the purple bit shows me that these are all the places that the top left corner of my 2x2 square could go. And I count them up. And I get 49. And then I have my second kind of key moment. There's a pattern forming. I'm seeing some square numbers here. So let's try it out with the 3x3s. I use my same kind of thinking, and I see that there are 36, or 6 squared. And so now, as a lazy mathematician, I extend the pattern, check if it adds up to 204, and that's what we've got. And so I'm feeling kind of happy. But I'm not going to rest there. I'm thinking ahead. I'm thinking about different size chessboards. What if I had a 10 by 10 or a 20 by 20? What if my chessboard was rectangular and not square? What if I had different types of grids? So here we might need to think about right way up and upside down triangles, which is how my pre-service teachers framed it. And maybe I'd like to even think in other dimensions. And I'm also thinking about how different the problem would have felt if I had to find the number of squares rather than confirm it was 204. Okay, so let's now dissect the mathematical processes and attitudes that were involved. So we're going to go back through this problem rather quickly, but focus on the mathematical processes. So that getting started moment, entering into the problem, involved a bit of notice and wonder and a bit of stuck, I don't know what to do, aha, 204 squares, I must be counting more than the one by ones. So that was the way that I entered the problem. And then however briefly, possibly just even in your mind's eye, you're turning to specific examples, just randomly. You're thinking, okay, I'm going to try and count all of these things and I'm going to hope there are 204 of them. But what happens here, as we're sketching it out and playing with it, like the photos that you saw of my students, the problem becomes less intimidating. And that specializing has given us a way forward. We know what we need to count, and we're going to choose a way to organize our work. And now we tackle the problem by breaking it into smaller pieces. I'm just going to go along and focus on counting them one at a time. Our thinking moves out of the entry phase and into the attack phase when we feel like the question has moved inside us and become our own. So now I'm pretty clear about what I need to do. I'm just going to get to work and do it. And I'm going to work systematically to count the number of 2x2 squares. This part was noticing patterns and generalizing. Now we're specializing artfully to test our conjecture that the next one is going to be a square number. And we're generalizing what could be true, what is the pattern, and why could it be true? So my approach of tracking the top left square was part of a justification. And maybe we'd need to be more rigorous about that, and maybe not. We start moving into the review phase when we check that our pattern extends down to one squared and we get 204 as required. But what's key here is that we're also reflecting on key moments. So in retrospect, I reckon it would have helped to start counting the largest squares first rather than the smaller squares. And that isn't my observation. That's one that plenty of students have made to me over the years. And I love it because it's not a way that I thought about doing this problem at all. And by large squares, I mean count the 7x7s as the very next step. And we might also reflect on whether there's another different way to count these squares to confirm our result. And finally, the review phase also thinks about generalizing beyond this problem and extending to other problems. So what I like about the chessboard squares problem, and indeed any kind of open problem of this nature, is that it highlights so many aspects of problem solving. We made use of the twin processes of specializing and generalizing. So we're switching between these to get ourselves a feel for the problem and to generalize, to check our generalizations and so on. And we also had three main phases of work, if you like, a start, a middle, and an end. So this framework is from Mason, Burton, and Stacey, and it's a useful representation. But I want to point out that this isn't a rigid structure. You don't say to yourself, I have finished the entry phase and I'm now starting the attack phase. It's a very fluid process. But I think you might agree that most problems have these three. You're getting started, you're doing some stuff in the middle, and then you're finishing off the problem. So getting started is key. There's a whole bunch of questions we could ask ourselves to get started. There are helpful actions like notice and wonder, writing down what we know, trying to explain our ideas to someone else, specializing, representing information in another way, you know, all of those kinds of things. But if I can be so bold, I think the authors miss two key points. The first one is, what is the question? And I'm thinking here of provocative prompts like three-act tasks, where I need to pose my own question, because that is the work of mathematicians. And the other one what does my intuition tell me? So mathematicians use intuition in a way that we typically don't value when our students do it. And I could do a whole hour on intuition, but instead I think you should go and read Tracy Zager's chapter on intuition, because she says it much more eloquently than I could. And we've talked about what happens at the end of problem solving. You need to reflect on the key ideas and moments. So we don't actually learn from our experience, we learn from reflecting on our experience. That's how we build up the reservoir of mathematical knowledge that we can draw on next time we're presented with a problem. So I want to briefly have a look at the attack phase, and I'm going to be a bit ambitious here and do what I do in a face-to-face workshop. I'm going to give you four problems and pick the one that's most interesting to you, and just get started on it for a couple of minutes, and then we'll chat about them at the end, the strategies you used. And this time, feel free to discuss your ideas in the chat window. Just don't give away the solution to a puzzle. Talk about your strategies. Okay, so I'm hoping people are sitting there thinking about one of these puzzles, thinking about the strategies they might use. If you want to chat about it in the chat window, go right ahead. Just say which problem you're thinking about and what strategies you're thinking about using, or how you're tackling it. Nice. So Tyson's got us started. He's thinking about counter logic, and he says he's trying each case. I'd like to know what that means, because I can think of a couple of ways of approaching this problem and splitting it into cases. Okay, so Eric's identified an important point in spotless dice, which is that dice have an invariant feature, that they're opposite sides sum to seven. Oh, nice. So Nathan's got a table of possibilities for each counter, which is the other way I was thinking about approaching this problem. So Tyson's talking about one statement true, the rest false. Nathan's thinking about a table of possibilities. Oh, lovely. So Beth is sharing about the cube puzzle, comparing two views with two patterns in common. So I'm not going to say anything. Reading. Ah, nice, Tracy. So Tracy's commenting on which cubes to choose. Sarah or Sarah, I'm not sure, sorry, made a net. Oh, lovely. It's so interesting doing this when I can't see any of you. All right, I'm going to give it, I think, one more minute. Is anyone going to be disappointed if Howard shares his patterns? Speak now. If you want him to keep it quiet for a while. So I love the kind of thinking that's coming out here, and I'm sure there's so many more things that are going through your heads as well that you're not typing in. I want to go through these four problems in a very overarching way to talk about the kinds of strategies that we've been using. So if it's a problem that you've thought about, just jump into the chat window and add your thoughts as well. So let's start with the cool years problem. I was thinking that given that I have to count them all, I'd want to work systematically. I could use one solution to find another. So if I increase one of the digits, I'll need to decrease the digit to keep the sum to 9. So 1 could go up to 2 and 6 could go down to 5 and so on. And I could use one solution to find another. I could find properties that the answer has. So if the last two digits are going to have to sum to 2 less than a square number, so 1 and 6 sum to 7, summing to 2 less than a square number. And also considering the extremes. So what is the smallest square that I could make here? So the smallest square that these digits could sum to is going to be 4, right? Because I've already got 2, so I can only play with the last two digits and get them to sum to the other two that I need. And what is the largest square I can make? So considering the extremes of the problem is really helpful here as well. Did anyone have other strategies in cool years that they were thinking of that I haven't mentioned? I think I'm taking that as a cue to move on. Maybe you're madly typing. We can look back through this later. Okay, so the next one, the cube puzzle. In some sense, very different strategies here. So searching for relationships between opposite sides and analyzing relationships between adjacent sides. So I saw Beth and Tracy mentioning that they use the two middle cubes to tell us something about the S and the O. So I'm using those to eliminate the possibility of what must be opposite that square. Use the S and the O to show me that what must be opposite the square is the cross. And someone, I'm sorry, I've forgotten who, was talking about changing the representation. So maybe make a net and even turn it into a physical model and put them on and see how you go. And then, of course, we could extend the problem to think how many of these 6 views are actually needed. So Liana, sorry about the pronunciation, has just said the orientation of the arrow might help. And that's exactly right. It might help us eliminate possibilities. Moving to the counter logic one. This one's been discussed a bit in the chat window already. We can partition the problem up into cases and then eliminate the ones that don't work. And so there's a couple of ways we could partition this problem. We could split it up into the three cases where one statement is true and the rest are false, and work them through and see if they lead to a contradiction. Or we could consider the six different colour combinations. So A is red, blue is white, and C is blue. B is white and C is blue, or the other five possibilities. And again, we could change the physical represent to a physical representation as well. And the final problem, this is from David Butler. It's his problem, and I put some links up earlier in the chat window. Spotless die. So we have a net of a standard die. Some spots have been removed. What number was originally on each face? We could just try something, see what happens. We could, as Eric said, look for a feature that doesn't change about dice. So we know that the opposite sides, or if you don't, we know now, should sum to 7. So that could be helpful in eliminating possibilities and focusing on one aspect. And this problem's a bit deeper in that you might need to backtrack to explore alternatives as well. So I picked these just to try and kind of illustrate that certain problems bring out different strategies that could be at play. And I've put together a 4-page document with about 24 lists of strategies at this tiny URL. There's nothing in there yet, but there will be at the end. And the strategies draw heavily from this book on the left, from Leonie Burton, Thinking Things Through. And incidentally, the framework that I mentioned before comes from the book on the right. So that one has been influential in shaping how I've come to view problem solving. And I'd say both books are excellent sources of problems from K, primary school level, all the way up to university level. If you are going to buy the one on the right, be sure to get the second edition, because some of it is linked to curriculum topics as well. Okay. Awesome. People sharing other ones in the chat window as well. So just backing up to the course, I meet with my pre-service teachers twice a week, 2 hours each time we meet, over 12 weeks. So I see them 24 times, just to give you some context. And each week we focus on an aspect of this problem-solving framework. So 5 weeks kind of looking at the entry phase, that's where we're focusing, but of course we solve problems through to the end if we want to, and then 6 weeks looking at the attack phase and 1 week interspersed looking at the review phase. And when I'm picking problems for my students to work on, I like to think about how their shape aligns with the focus of the week. So when I'm talking about the entry phase, I might be looking for problems that are very open at the start. Nearly always I'm looking for problems that are open in the middle, and sometimes I'm looking for problems that are open at the end. So this forms the backbone of the 12-week course, but there's another thread that's running through the entire 12 weeks, and that's developing oral and written communication skills. So we have a leisurely 20 minutes to talk about that, so I'm going to switch focus now and talk completely about communicating mathematically. Okay, so this is the common way that most people approach writing up a solution to an idea, a research idea or something in class. And note how closely this mirrors what was said about Feynman's problem-solving process from earlier. Students often tackle writing in the same way. Up until my PhD, I've been able to do most of my thinking in my head and then commit it to paper once I'd completely thought it through, and what came out of my pen was just essentially perfect, right? Not much revision was needed. When I got to my PhD, it was too big to do in my head, and this approach turned into a severe stumbling block for me, along with a whole bunch of things about being perfect the first time and all of that kind of thinking. So the problem was that I fell into thinking that writing was the end product rather than part of the process. And this linear approach to writing is inefficient in mathematics, and it's inefficient in other disciplines too. Because if we switch it around, writing can be a really effective way of solving problems. It's actually much better to start writing when we start thinking. And I'm going to broaden this from writing papers to talking mathematics as well. So you might need some individual think time right at the beginning, but eventually, as you're solving the problem, as you're thinking about it, you should be writing or you should be communicating with other people. Because writing and talking about our ideas helps us to crystallize what we don't understand. And in particular, writing them down means we can critically examine them in a way that is just not possible when they remain in a nebulous form in my head. And John is exactly right. It's why I write blog posts too, although mine aren't very often. You organize your thoughts. You can examine them. Writing it down also helps us to stop revisiting unsuccessful ideas as well. And of course, there are other benefits to learning to communicate mathematically. It's encouraging our students to articulate and to justify their thinking and to listen to and make sense of the ideas of others. Problems with many different ways to approach them also help students appreciate that there's more than one right way to think about mathematics. And so that's helping shape their affective aspects, their mathematical identity. It's increasing their confidence, encouraging participation, and expanding perceptions of mathematics beyond right and wrong and black and white. And of course, there are benefits of activating peer-to-peer learning when we expect students to talk and communicate mathematically with each other. So I have this diagram up on my pinboard. It was originally used to represent the design process, but I think it captures the messy way that problem solving evolves over time, both in terms of the clarity of our thinking and the way that we communicate it. So really messy at the start, but we get clarity and focus toward the end. So time is running from left to right. And I keep it on my pin-up board because it reminds me that the left is a really important part of the thinking and the writing process. And yet, typically maths assessment, at least at universities, is focused entirely on the right. So it's almost always evaluating final thinking in written form. It's submitted to the expert, you know, so me, for scrutiny, and it is nearly always high stakes. And the project in my course is a really good example of this. So students undertake an in-depth mathematical investigation of a puzzle of their own choosing. So I've put a list of the kinds of topics they work on in the Dropbox, but here are some examples below. They might look at the Towers of Hanoi puzzle. They might look at determining which corner a billiard ball will end up in if this grid has any number of rows and columns. So they undertake their own mathematical investigation. And eventually, they need to communicate a polished resolution to their problem in a report and into a final presentation. But these can be really daunting projects for students who are used to solving exercises in a textbook. This is essentially their own little mathematical research process. And so writing and talking about their investigations can really help. So the project and the final report and the final presentation is certainly on the right-hand side of this diagram. But the left-hand side is just as important, if not more so. It is what supports what happens on the right-hand side. The left-hand side's about communicating to learn. It's about getting feedback from peers, it values draft thinking, it talks about interacting with others, and also getting feedback from yourself, writing your ideas down, like Janae is saying, and evaluating them, thinking and an active learning process. So My own experience at university level says that students focus on what we assess. And if we want them to see the merit in and practice these other dimensions of writing and thinking, we need to build our assessment accordingly. But that's why I've said it should be no stakes or low stakes to allow room for growth. So I've designed this this picture using backward design principles to create the earlier supportive activities. If I want to build up to fabulous final presentations and final reports, I need to help my students progress to that stage. And I'm going to spend the last 15 minutes we have looking at some particular strategies that have helped me in each of these phases. And I will say right now, many of my ideas come from the MIT-BOSS as well. So there's going to be quite a few shout outs through here. So let's talk first about developing oral communication skills and mathematical discussions, which is the left-hand side of this diagram. So at university, at least, where students typically come and sit passively in a lecture and then go off to tutorials, there can often not be a lot of mathematical discussion. So for me, early on in the course, I set an expectation that all students will talk maths in each class to somebody else. It might not be to everybody, it might be to their neighbour, but it will happen. And then we establish group norms for communication. You know, no idea is a stupid idea. When you're discussing problem solving with others, what's helpful to share, what's not helpful to share. It needs to be okay to say, I want some time by myself as well. And then use structures that support the skill that you're looking for. So I want the most number of people sharing ideas, I might use a speed dating structure. If I want them to practice listening, I might use a structure that requires them to report back somebody else's idea. And then model good communication as well. So I've pinched an example here from Chris Lozniak of using debate cards. So I learnt about this from Chris and from Maddie Baker at Twitter Math Camp in July. And the idea here is randomly pair students up. One person is always person A, the other one is person B, and they have to present a case for their point. So person A might say, I claim that finding the area by adding up pieces is best, and my reason, Chris would say my warrant, but my reason is that I don't want to multiply 12 by 21, but I'm okay multiplying 12 by 11, that kind of idea. So I'm just looking for a link for some ideas for this one. But Chris has lots of good suggestions on making maths debatable. You should go and look at his website, and he's going to put out a book next year, I hear, as well. Okay, early in the course as well, I ask my students to brainstorm features of good and bad talks. I share very early on what the rubric is for the final presentation, and maybe we'll even co-design it. I've put that rubric in the Dropbox as well. But along the way, what I want to do is to build up their ability to present to others. So I'm going to talk about progressively building presentation skills through low-stakes mini talks. So these are things that we do every week from week four. And we cover off different aspects. So we're gradually increasing the talk duration, the group size, the audience familiarity, the presentation style. And then we use the final rubric for skills to focus on each week. And I'm going to give you a particular example in a moment. I'll say it's a binary marking scheme. It's one if you turn up to class and do it, and it's zero if you don't. I don't go around and judge the quality of talks. That's not the point. And their accountability will be to their peers anyway, because it's pretty embarrassing to turn up and not be prepared. So here's the first page of the two-page progression for these mini talks. The first one is as straightforward as I can make it. It's a three-minute talk at your desk to a friend on a topic that I will give you. So the two topics this year was the Koch snowflake and the collapse of the hailstone conjecture. And we're just focusing on getting started. So the listener gives lots of encouraging feedback and one suggestion for improvement. And we're thinking in particular about time, volume, and rate. So was your talk too long or too short? Did you speak too loud or fast? And were you too fast or too slow? So that's a prompt for self-reflection, it's a prompt for feedback, and then the idea is, at least in this structure, that you get to revise and improve on that talk next week. So right from the beginning, building in structures for drafting something and then making revisions as well. And then as we go on, you can see that the skills are getting more complex. So the talks are getting longer, the mode of communication is moving very quickly to the whiteboard, we're moving to visibly random groupings, choosing your own topic, there's a skill in that, and focusing on other aspects of the rubric. So for instance, by talk seven, 4 minutes, four people in your group, and you're starting to think about more complex skills. Did you summarise and end your talk smoothly? Did you make eye contact with all audience members? Did you use pauses effectively? Did you pre-prepare handouts? So you can see how these are developing, and students often mention that these mini talks are one of the best aspects of the course because they're gradually increasing their skills and confidence, and it makes their final presentation far less daunting. If we switch for 5 minutes to talk about written communication, I would stress again, it's important to start writing from day one. I'm going to say something that's a bit controversial, at least at the beginning. I emphasise getting ideas on paper and I don't mark for mathematical correctness. So tell me what you did to start the problem. Tell me the ideas that you tried to get into the problem, and then reflect in some way. And then I'm using a strategy that I learned from Fawn Nguyen about marking or giving feedback with a highlighter. So I'll mark that one up as well. I think John can fix that for me. So quick feedback that puts the emphasis on working out what to do back on the learner, and then structures for revision. And to give you a particular example, they hand up their solution to a problem in week two, and they need to specifically ask for feedback on 1 point or 2 points. So have I explained my thinking well enough? That kind of thing. When I give the feedback, I address their question and I give them something else to respond to. And then the next week, they hand that back. So I'll put both of those again in the Dropbox for you to have a bit more of a look at later. Okay, so building in this idea that you need to start writing your mathematics and that you can always improve it using structures for revision. For the project itself, I learned, it took me ages, I don't know why, I learned that what I needed to do was focus my effort on the draft rather than the final, because the draft is where you have the ability to guide students and redirect them. So I get them to hand up a draft of their project about halfway through. And unlike what I used to do in English class, which was to write the whole essay and then to kind of artificially manufacture the draft from there. Hang on, can you hear me? Your microphone isn't transmitting a signal. Okay, all right, so I'm just going to ignore that message. Okay, so I'm very specific about the purpose of the draft. It will be incomplete. The purpose is to formulate, develop, and clarify ideas. You can see the list there. So I'm asking for a fairly polished introduction to help them articulate what the problem actually is, 1 to 2 pages in which they start to organise their problem-solving work, and then crucially, I also ask for 5 to 10 pages of evidence of their notes, and I don't grade them at all. What I'm looking for here is that they're starting to get their ideas down on paper. They're starting to try different avenues of thinking as well. And then I use one-on-one meetings with students, both to scope their project and to discuss the feedback that both myself and someone else here has given them on their draft, and just check in with them along the way. So let's talk a little bit about peer feedback. As you can imagine, again, early in the course, progressively build their skills with pretty informal activities in class. But what we're building up to is mirroring the process that professional mathematicians use. So I show them examples of good and bad reviews. I talk about the review process as a professional mathematician, which the first time you go through is utterly terrifying. And then we peer review each other's drafts. So giving feedback, writing a peer review letter, just as we would in professional maths land as well. Okay, so we're getting toward the end. In fact, we are right at the end. We covered off a whole bunch of ideas. And so in the last 3 minutes, I'm happy to answer any questions you have. You might like to reflect on some of these student reactions to the course. Of course, I've picked the ones that make me feel happy, but the last one is one that I love. So this student had picked for their project a question that it turned out needed a lot of algebra, and I hadn't realised that at the time because, let me tell you, I don't solve all the project topics that I make available to my students. I think, oh yeah, that'll be interesting, and I'll let them go for it. So he picked a problem that turned out needed a lot of algebra, and he wasn't a very strong math student. And he wrote in his reflection, look, I wouldn't have chosen this problem had I known what I know now, because I don't feel very confident using algebra. But looking back, I'm glad I decided to attempt this problem because it forced me to learn new mathematics and use the skills of thinking mathematically. And the thing I've highlighted at the bottom is up on my pin board because I love it so much. The reason for trying to solve a difficult problem shouldn't be because you already know that you can do it, but that you find some intrinsic mystery behind the problem which you want to understand. So he tackled this problem because it was interesting to him. And that's fabulous, because what he left with was more questions than answers. And he said, I still find myself wondering why. I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to answer this question. I don't even know where to start, but that's okay, because when I tackled the first problem, I didn't know what to do either, and I learned some things along the way. So it encapsulates for me where we're trying to get our students, to a place where they can pick problems because they're interesting, and then give them the skills and the confidence to go on and try and tackle them for themselves. So I am going to stop here. These are all the places that you can find me. I write an occasional blog at my website. I am addicted to Twitter, so that is the best place to find me. And I'm going to put a whole bunch of resources, some which I didn't even mention, at that web link in about 5 minutes' time. So thank you very much, folks, and I'm happy to hang around and answer questions as well.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. It is exactly the time. Just so everyone knows, the recording, so the link for tonight, the link you used to get into the